I think opt-in empire building is a great goal for our nation. I think our goal should be to get to 1 billion Americans and have America be the most populous and the most innovative country in the world. Now, how do you get to 1 billion from 350 million? You got to triple. And there's a certain amount of, you know, population growth through babies, but let's just say people aren't making a ton of babies. So there's two ways to accomplish this. You got to immigrate people, or you got to do a little empire building, opt-in, mm-hmm. of course. Maybe there's countries in Europe that would want to be, maybe Greece wants to be part of the United States. Wouldn't that be great for me if Greece was the 51st state, if they wanted to?
Why Greece?
Because I'm Greek.
Oh.
I'm, and because we created, man, the most, like, I mean, we created democracy. America perfected it. This would be full circle for me.
I'm so sorry. I did not know your heritage. So I'm like,
golly, Donis,
struggling demographics.
Where have you been?
Famous debt load. I'm like, dude, I'm not picking Greece.
That's
if I'm
why
picking...
I think it's an interesting concept.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Oracle. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI, is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Save up to 50% on your cloud bill at oracle.com/twist. Dev Squad. Most dev agencies only offer developers. Why? Because product management is hard. Get an entire product team for the cost of one U.S. developer plus 10% off at devsquad.com/twist. And Ramp, the corporate card and spend management software designed to help you save time and money. Get $250 when you join Ramp today at ramp.com/twist.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to This Week in Startups. We call it Twist. You can call it Twist if you want to. We are doing the show 3 days a week in 2025, Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. Trying to get consistent, about 10 a.m. start Pacific. Sometimes we're a little bit late. Sometimes we get a little early and set up the show. You get to watch us live, about 25% more show live on YouTube, X, and LinkedIn. If you sign up for those services, just search for This Week in Startups there. Search for Alex, search for myself. And you can follow us, turn on the bell on YouTube, and you'll get an alert when we start. We take questions from the audience, and a couple thousand people show up live across the platforms, which makes the show a little more dynamic. We get feedback in real time. But if you're part of the podcast gang, that's okay. You can join the Noti gang, N-O-T-I, the notification gang, by going to YouTube, clicking the bell after you subscribe and putting on all notifications. You can do the same on X, x.com/TWI Startups. With me again today, the one, the only, he's cautiously optimistic, Alex Wilhelm.
Hey, Jason. Two things. One, we finally got snow out here. So now when I see your background, I can also just see it out my window. Fewer skiers, similar look. And I just wanted to give a holiday shout out to all of our friends out there. This is a short week for Twist. It's a short week for pretty much everybody. If you're a Christmas person or if you are a Hanukkah person,
there you go.
May you please enjoy. This is a gift from a friend of mine who
beautiful.
Knows that I like heavy metal. But I think it's a good moment to dig through the news, and then we'll send everyone off for a short hibernation, and then we're back on Monday.
Oh, back on Monday. All right. So you got us today, you get us Monday, and we're going to do the Twisty Awards again, I think, on Monday, right?
We are going to do the Twisties.
Great yes, show Monday. We'll do our Twisties, the annual tradition. Before there were the Besties, I had started the Twisties. You started seeing a theme here. A lot of the all-in bits and stuff like that were built off This Week in Startups. If you're an all-in fan here, especially my Sacks and MAGA fans who come here to troll me, welcome. We love to talk a little bit of politics, but only in relation to technology here.
Yes.
We're not just going to talk about like random stuff or Ukraine or whatever. Here is for, you know, overlapping tech and politics, which we're going to do today a whole bunch. And
yes.
First up, over the weekend, I stepped into the palant. You know, sometimes I step in something, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever seen this on X, but sometimes I step in something.
I've seen it several times now.
Yes. So I walked into a hornet's nest. I didn't realize Palantir had an army of individuals who are very enthusiastic, like our friends with Bitcoin or the XRP army.
Mm-hmm.
There's an enthusiastic, vivacious, effervescent group of individuals who love the company Palantir. Now,
yes,
I've known Palantir forever. Joe Lonsdale's a friend. He's been on the SHIP program. He's the co-founder, and I love the CEO, Alex Karp of Palantir. He's so based. But it is a somewhat expensive stock that people are really promoting. And when you see massive promotion, especially on social media like X or YouTube, it's like X and YouTube seem to have won the conversation in finance. That's when I get a little bit of radar going up. So I thought today we'd start with, since so many people were like dunking on me, there was an all-in clip that came out.
Yes.
Which we'll put in the show notes. I don't know if we should play it here or not.
But no, we don't need to go through
that. We don't need to go through that whole thing. But the clip was basically me joking about, I guess we were talking about Cloudflare or whatever, and I just made a joke about how Palantir was deep state. Because, you know, Sachs loves to talk about the deep state. Palantir is as deep state gets. Sachs is a shareholder. Bill Lonsdale is a co-founder, obviously a shareholder. Everybody we know is a shareholder. It's a founder's friend of the company. And I was just like, yeah, they're deep state too. But somebody tweeted as if I was saying the stock wasn't, and trying to say I was making a stock call on it. I wasn't making a stock call on it. I was just joking about it being, there was no discussion about the stock price.
Well, Jason, I had your tweet. So, Jason, here is your tweet about this. You make an argument that really speaks to my soul because you're talking about price earnings ratios and price sales ratios, or just sales multiples here.
Let's read the tweet. Yeah.
So okay. Jason says, I think we were joking about them, Palantir, being part of the deep state, not stock price, but at a 400 price earnings ratio and a 65x sales multiple, exclamation points, looks like a good time to take some profits on the name. In fact, and this is spicy, insiders told me they are selling into this insanity. And
yeah,
this
is in response
to Sachs.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Sachs was like redunking the tweet. And listen, he gets a lot of calls right. Obviously, he wouldn't be where he is if he wasn't smart. So, a lot of people I've heard, you know, like at cocktail parties or whatever, you know, I literally heard folks saying, "Hey, I'm trimming at this level." I hear that. Now, I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know how much they have. I don't know if they're trimming one share or a billion shares. I'm just saying the buzz I've heard from people who maybe own shares is, "Hey, this is a good time to maybe trim if you got in very early." You know, you could be certain if, you know, Robinhood, Uber, you know, DoorDash, or other companies that I own shares in, including Facebook, Google, Apple. I own a bunch of different individual stocks that I've made trades on, or I own from their private companies. If it was trading at 65 times sales, you could bet I would be trimming my position. Now, this is not financial advice, but I just wanted to ask you, since you're, you know, a deep data finance nerd, which is why you're here, where does Palantir's multiples, and this is a great company, with a great CEO and a great team, incredible growth. I know they're growing like close to 30% year over year, something in that ballpark. Yeah. And, you know, I this is just a discussion over the price, because once I added Palantir, I don't own shares in it, although I think I might own shares through, like, you know, mutual funds and stuff like that, obviously. I was just trying to wonder how expensive this is right now.
Yeah,
because that when I did add it to my Apple stocks, there was a lot of stories about, oh, my Lord, this is an incredible run up.
Yep. So one thing I think that's important to show is just how quickly the company has appreciated in value. So we're going to go ahead and pull up a chart now on the screen. And this shows Palantir's price sales ratio. Now, Jason, for those who don't know, price sales in public market terms is last 12 months revenue, four quarters, divided by. Sorry, it's your valuation divided by your sales, essentially.
Got it.
This chart goes vertical as we approach the last couple of months. And I think this type of appreciation makes people greedy and very enthusiastic. But when you see a chart like this, Jason, that goes vertical in a valuation terms, it makes you wonder what's driving such insane near-term appreciation. Yeah.
Right. So we would know in the case of, say, Eli Lilly, it was the, you know, Ozempic or Zepbound or whatever. We would know, because I'm assuming their chart does something similar there, although their sales did skyrocket. So then we might see a similar chart with an NVIDIA, as an example, when they move from just doing, you know, their main category being gaming GPUs to server farms becoming the majority of their revenue. We've seen those charts before. So there can be explanations for massive acceleration. Somebody could get a huge contract, right? Mm-hmm. You could have somebody from, let's say, the CHIPS Act, you know, Intel or TSMC could get a couple of $1 billion in loans or grants dropped on their head from the U.S. government to build a foundry in the United States. So that is not unprecedented. And I guess Palantir sells into the government. Peter Thiel's biggest bets were Facebook, J.D. Vance, Trump, you know, Palantir, Founders Fund itself. I mean, he's got an incredible record. And I don't know if anybody's ever had a betting record that dipped into politics like this, because now with these appointments, which we'll talk about next, it's looking like a lot of Thiel folks are in the administration. Let's keep going.
I want to stay on the price sales point, because you asked about the NVIDIA chart, and if we could just share the screen again. Here is NVIDIA's price sales ratio, Jason. Actually, not what you and I both expected, which was a vertical ascent up into the right. It's actually been relatively static since, it's actually where it was in mid-2022, which is shocking to me. This just goes to show that NVIDIA's valuation has scaled as its revenue has also increased so quickly that it's actually kept up with the appreciation in its value.
All right, let's talk about AI, everybody. It's everywhere. Self-driving cars, breakthrough medical research, and of course, business tools that make everybody better and faster at their jobs. If AI hasn't hit your industry yet, trust me, it is on the way and it's happening fast. But AI requires a ton of computing power, you know that. And those costs will skyrocket if you're not careful. I have seen these bills come in. It can get crazy quick. And that's why it's time for you to upgrade to the next generation of cloud. And that means Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a blazing, fast, and secure platform that covers all the bases. Infrastructure, databases, app development, and of course, all your startups' AI and machine learning needs. Now here's the kicker. OCI costs 50% less for compute and 80% less for network compared to other cloud options. That's a lot of savings, especially when every minute counts in the cloud. Thousands of businesses have already upgraded to OCI, including MGM Resorts, Specialized Bikes, and Fireworks AI. So here's your call to action. Right now, if you switch to OCI, Oracle is offering to cut your current cloud bill in half for new U.S. customers with minimum financial commitment. But you'll need to act fast. The offer ends December 31st, 2024. See if your company qualifies for this special offer at oracle.com/twist. Oracle.com/twist.
What this says is that people are looking at the valuation in relation to sales. They're very attuned to what the top line sales is, the sales line is, and then they're doing the math to say, what's the price to sales ratio here? What's reasonable given their growth? And they were doubling revenue a year at one point, I believe.
NVIDIA? More than that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's three-digit growth year over year is unprecedented.
It's absolutely insane.
15 to 30% is high growth in public market companies. NVIDIA grew like a startup, a Series A startup, going from 3 to 10 million or 10 to 30 million, which does happen. You showed the Google chart at one point last week. So this is disconnected from reality. You tell me what, because if this is is it disconnected from reality?
Yes. Okay.
So let me check with you.
Yeah. Okay. So I went through their last earnings report, and I just want to point out that, as you said earlier, this is a really good company. So revenue growth last quarter, Jason, 30%, 7% quarter on quarter. And I would say more importantly, inside the U.S., revenue growth is 44% year over year. So very impressive.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
The customers count up 30% year over year. And GAAP profitable, so their net income had a 20% margin in the last quarter, and they have about $1 billion in trailing operating cash flow. So profitable, kicking off cash, growing quickly, and increasingly diversified customer base.
So where does Palantir sit? I guess, you know, putting things in context, super important. Are there other companies trading at 60 or 70 price to sales ratios right now in the market? I asked ChatGPT and Gemini. Gemini wouldn't give me finance information. Come on, Google.
Really?
I know a lot of the Googlers are listening to the show, and we've been giving so much great praise to what they've been working on, but I couldn't get the Google finance in. The Google finance team's behind. So where does Palantir sit versus other stocks when we look at a price to sales ratio?
Yep.
And by the way, this all goes back to startups. There is a time in which your valuation can get ahead of itself. When that happens in private markets, you know, the people who are giving the investments in those cases have downside protection. They're called protective provisions. So they get their money out first. So if the company does get sold, and let's say I put $10 million into your company at $1 billion valuation for about 1% of it, and the company's making $10 million, so it's 100 times revenue. It's 100 times, price to sales ratio. Well, if the company was sold for $50 million or $10 million in a fire sale, my $10 million comes out first. Mm-hmm. That's what happens with private stock. That's why VCs will make, you know, crazy bets, like, or seemingly crazy bets. on a stock that's high growth and to beat another venture firm. So if you're a venture firm Acme and I'm venture firm Delta, and you offered $500 million valuation to that startup to put $10 million in for 2%, and then I come in and I say, I'll put $20 million in for 2%. So I'm going to pay twice the valuation. If we both believe this is going to be a $100 billion company, all I'm doing is losing the gain from a billion to 2 billion that you're insisting on getting, or 500 million, the difference between 500 and a billion. You're getting that first double. I'm saying, you know what, I'll give up that first double. I'll just play for everything after it. And that's why you see crazy valuations in private markets. In public markets, typically people like to make money and they don't have that downside protection. So they are like, well, let's make sure we reevaluate every day the stock market is trading. What makes sense here? And this obviously, I guess the correlation here is we are going to have a more efficient government under Trump 2.0. That's their promise to us, the American people, if we take them at their word. And I actually do at this point. We'll get into that in a minute. That they want to lower spending, they want to lower the debt, and they want to have a more efficient government. Well, where would you go to have a more efficient military? You go to Anduril, you go to Palantir, you would go to SpaceX. These private companies have lowered the cost of getting to space or building missiles by 90%. So then, of course, you would go to them. So Palantir does have a bright future. Maybe that 30, 40% growth is going to go to 60, 70% growth. Maybe it is the next NVIDIA, and that's the bet people are making.
So Jason makes a great point about other companies that might have a similar set of accounting or perhaps a similar focus. I found a couple of names. Splunk, Tableau, and Alteryx are all companies that we think of when we consider big data and perhaps visualizations of it. Sadly for us, Splunk was bought by Cisco for about $28 billion in March. Tableau got bought by Salesforce, and Alteryx was taken private by Clearlake and Insight. So where does that leave us in trying to understand where Palantir sits?
Well, so we don't know for those three what the sales were at that time, or we have a guess?
I don't recall the exact price sales ratio of those companies, but the point is they're off the table, and they're off the table far enough in the past that I think they wouldn't be directly comparable to Palantir today. But two companies that are, Jason, at least related. One is C3.ai, does AI stuff for the enterprise, currently trading at a price sales ratio of 13. So about 1/5 of what we're seeing from Palantir. And that was as low as about 10x in recent quarters. And then the other one, when we think about big data, warehousing, leveraging that information, Snowflake, a very well-run company. We've talked about them here on the show a lot. Well, their price sales ratio today is 16.2x, when as high as 24. In the last couple of quarters, Jason, but I couldn't find anything at scale in these areas that had a price sales ratio, revenue multiple of anything even approaching Palantir. Mm. But people are willing to overpay for expectations. And so when you look at, you know, Trump Media or, you know, whatever you call that company, TMTG,
Donald Trump,
people will pay for it.
Yeah, people will pay for it. Okay. Well, so a great company. Probably dipping into meme status if, when I talk about it, so many people are like, have fun staying bored. Like, when you see people pumping, that's when you know that you should be more cautious. I'm not going to say that's when you know there's like funny business going around, but literally this weekend, there was a fake news story about Bezos spending $600 billion on his, $600 million, not billion, on his wedding. He's spending $600 billion on his wedding. Everybody who comes is a billionaire.
Right. You get a free $1 billion in your goodie bag and your name tag.
Exactly. So, no. So Bezos had to come out and say, I'm not spending $600 million on my wedding. Do you know what the first reply I saw to his tweet was?
What was it?
Michael Saylor. So, go ahead and
my God. Are you serious?
Go ahead and do a search for it.
Look for Jeff Bezos and you'll find it.
The funniest thing I've ever seen.
All right. Take a second and picture the ultimate all-star team for your startup. Okay, you got that mental image? Maybe the Avengers, maybe even X-Men, Wolverine, Cyclops, pick your favorite superhero team. And let's be realistic. Until you've raised your Series A or your Series B, you might need some help building that dream team and finding top-tier talent, managing all the timelines you've got, and maintaining quality. It's a big lift for all founders. I mean, scouting for that elusive 10x developer, that's going to eat all your time. And that's where DevSquad comes in. Think of them as like Professor X, you know, they know where to find those exceptional mutant developers who are 10x devs. And DevSquad offers a complete product team from Latin America. You're going to get 2 to 6 full stack developers, a technical product manager, and specialists in case you need them, like product strategy or UI and UX design, DevOps, and of course, quality assurance, all for 75% less than a US-based team, while being on your same time zone, which is really important. There's no long-term commitment. It's just seamless collaboration. So if you want a GSD, if you want to get stuff done and you're ready to squad up, head to devsquad.com/twist for 10% off your first engagement. That's devsquad.com/twist and transform your startup with the all-star team it deserves.
The story comes out. Bizarre to even see a story like this. Press not doing themselves any favors. So the press, if you scroll up a little bit, you'll see the top. The press, you know, did the story, which you can't see here, about the $600 million. So Bezos comes out and says, furthermore, this whole thing is completely false. None of this has happened. And the old adage, don't believe everything you read, is even more true today than it ever has been. Been throwing shade at the press, owner of the Washington Post. Now lies can get all the way around the world before the truth can get its pants on. So be careful out there, blah, 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 blah. Michael Saylor's reply.
$600 million would buy a lot of Bitcoin. Here's the thing, though, Jason. That's not true. Because in Michael Saylor's estimation, anything less than $2 or $3 billion worth of Bitcoin purchases is just chump change. I mean, he's out there buying real Bitcoin, not that $600 million fake crap.
That's a like an interesting segue here. I'll just give you another tweet. As of this morning, December 23rd, Merry Christmas.
Oh, my gosh.
Michael Saylor reports MicroStrategy has acquired 5,262 BTC for $561 million.
Dang it.
$600 million. He literally bought the $600 million last week.
I have never eaten my words so quickly in my life. But I do want to make a small point there about the press comment that you made, which is we are discussing the New York Post.
Yes.
Which I believe is part of the Murdoch empire, Jason.
You know, the New York Post isn't the one who reported it. I think they were reporting that it was fake. So... Yes. So you know how the press is. Somebody, if one of the outlets gets something wrong, the other press pile on about it. But of course, this led to crazy chaos online. But yeah, it's
$600 million for a wedding. I mean, that's like buying a castle, tearing it down, rebuilding the castle, tearing it down, rebuilding it, and then inviting everyone in England. Like, I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, this is crazy. It's not true, obviously. But there was, I mean, it's not without precedent. Wasn't an heir to an Indian fortune, didn't he just throw like $100 million or $200 million wedding where he paid, you know, a bunch of major celebrities, just giant appearance fees?
Ambani family. I would say the robber barons of modern India, to use a historical American analogy to a certain gilded era.
They have it.
And there's been some discussions about potential fraud in certain major family-run business empires in India.
Just
pointing that out. The thing, though, about Palantir, I do want to make sure we're giving the positive vibes here. And I did go through their product lineup, and what they built is very impressive, and they're proud of themselves for doing well. The thing that hit me was this FT story from the last couple of days, in which it discusses a new conglomeration of the companies you're discussing working together. So when you talk about SpaceX and Palantir and Anduril, we think of them as discrete units, but I think that they really want to operate more together. So the FT reports that Palantir and Anduril and other companies are, quote, in talks with about a dozen competitors to form a consortium that will jointly bid for U.S. government work in an effort to disrupt the country's oligopoly of prime contractors.
Awesome.
Yes, that was exactly my first reaction.
Great.
Because even if there's a lot of self-dealing here amongst the Thiel and PayPal Mafia folks, it'll still be less corrupt and better than what we currently have.
Well, I mean, it's a free market. So, you know, if you look at what's happening right now, I think there's like a duopoly basically in these contracts. You get the same two or three people each time doing cost plus bidding.
Ugh.
What this new group of defense tech companies are doing is not cost plus. They're just saying, here's what I can sell this to you. How many do you want?
Yeah.
And so if they offer, as we had the submarine company on, the unmanned submarine company, you'll remember, my short-term memory's gone. That company I think they said they were making them for 50 to 100K and they would normally cost 500 to 750. The Titan submersible, thank you. If you were to take the Titan submersible, you know, maybe the government's like, you know what, we were going to buy 1,000 of these, but since they're 90% cheaper, we'll take 2,000 and we'll have a new plan. So if you were going to defend against new enemies, new possibilities, if there's a vibrant competition going on here and startups are included in it, and it's not fixed and it's not based on like who gave the most money, or it's a new group of people who are exerting their influence through our system, which includes money, it's better for us because prices will go down and the value will go up of these products. And no competition, if you look at the things that have gone up in cost in the United States, the top things that have gone up in cost are healthcare, education, especially higher education, healthcare, education, and housing. And if you look at those three, they are the most regulated and government participatory verticals that we have. And if you take some regulation out and there was like more college degrees were available from different folks, or there was a more open healthcare system, insurance system, maybe we'd see a little bit. I wonder where military is in terms of the acceleration of costs. And if we are going to lower the budget, you could actually get more functionality and capability with startups making weapons, defense systems, et cetera, for less money. So more for less? Who's not taking more for less?
No, it's absolutely lovely. I do think that the cost plus accounting that we've seen is essentially just a license to be incompetent, to run out timelines and to take in more money. It's literally saying, please bilk us. So I'm glad that that is out of favor. I will say, though, I don't want to compare Anduril and Vatten Systems and everyone else to Titan Submersible, because that submersible was cheaper and failed. What I'm excited about is cheaper and better, because I bet you, Jason, I'm sure you actually agree with me here, but I bet these companies will make better products for cheaper. So it's not just more and cheaper. It's
No, these are going to be much better. Yeah, better and cheaper. And so, you know, there's a number of examples of this. If you go take an Airbnb, you might have a better experience if you like a kitchen and a backyard when you rent a house than getting a suite or 3 one-bedrooms or 3 rooms at a typical hotel in the same city. So if that's the case, this is a similar situation where you're going to get a better product produced differently. And I can tell you, entrepreneurs are all of a sudden asking themselves, I wonder if I could do something with drones. That sounds kind of fun. That sounds kind of profitable as a business. That sounds kind of helpful to the world. So entrepreneurs are getting into defense tech. They're looking at all these areas. They're saying, how can I? And we had the founder of the self-driving company that does remote control of cars to drop off
your
rental car.
In Vegas, yeah.
Yes. And so, you know, that company, a great founder, it will come to me in a second, is also working in defense tech. So you can imagine, you know, if you're in the field and you want a Humvee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how do I get a Humvee to you? You're 100 miles away.
Well, I was going to say drive it, but I presume that's not the
right
answer.
Now you got to put 4 people into a Humvee to drive it to you, and then maybe they need to have another Humvee following them to get them back.
Yeah.
And then maybe you need a Apache to give them some air cover and throw up a drone. You want to send one Humvee into the field, you could send it alone.
Yes.
Just some guy with a joystick, gal with a joystick, boom, zipping it right to the front line. So, or maybe you need to put some stuff into it. Maybe you need some more ammunition. Boom, you send a Humvee remote control. It's going to be awesome. And so you do need to be vigilant. Anytime we have this kind of situation, I'm not saying like people shouldn't be vigilant and question everything, but we are entering a new era clearly. And I thought we should talk about some more of the of my contemporaries, I'll say, people of my generation getting into politics. My friend Ken Howery, who was previously an investor at Founders Fund, or co-founder, I think he's technically a co-founder, and was at PayPal. He's now going to be the ambassador to Denmark, and he was previously the ambassador to Sweden. So he's back in the mix. He's a good friend of mine.
Did you see the Trump post about this? We're going to put it up on the screen right now. We're going to pull it up. And this is all standard stuff here. But then he says, for the purposes of national security and freedom throughout the world, the US of A feels that the ownership and control of Greenland is an absolute necessity. Now we can take that off the screen. But usually ambassadorships, Jason, are just well-funded boondoggles. Like Calista Gingrich just got the ambassadorship to Switzerland, which I presume is going to be her bouncing around castles eating chocolates for a couple years for free.
Yeah.
I thought that they were sticking Ken in a relatively unimportant ambassadorship until I saw the Greenland thing. So are they serious about this?
Hey, everybody, I want to tell you about an awesome corporate card and spend management software that's designed to help you save money. Basically, it puts money back in your pocket. It's called Ramp, and we use it here at Launch. My COO, Heidi, our chief operating officer, loves it because Ramp gives you visibility into your company's software usage. And this is going to help you trim your subscription costs, and it allows you to issue cards to every employee and then give them limits and restrictions. So we do this. Sometimes we'll have the whole team go to an offsite. We send everybody a Ramp card. Everybody has a certain amount of money they can spend, and they don't have to worry about using their personal cards or submitting an expense report or any of that drama. No. And Ramp customers save about 5% on their expenses every year because you can do things like dial up and dial down how much money can be charged to a card. Ramp software is so smart. You no longer have to do manual expense reports either. And they'll even play bad cop for your company, chasing down missing documentation and requesting repayment. Ramp's so easy to use, and you can start making payments in less than 15 minutes. So join Ramp right now, and they'll give you $250 right into your account, ramp.com/twist, ramp.com/twist. It is the best way to manage expenses for your team. It's elegant, it's dead simple, and it's going to save you money. Disclaimer, cards issued by Sutton Bank, members, FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
I don't know that it would have to be for sale. I would like the Japan one. I know Rahm Emanuel's got it right now, but I found out. I asked okay. How does this all work to some friends. And basically, you have to fund the ambassadorship. So people don't know this, but you as the individual who's going to be the ambassador to Sweden or France or Spain or whatever it is, you fund the operations of the embassy for those years. So it's going to cost you low millions of dollars to fund the parties, the staff, and all that kind of stuff. Yes.
That's not fun at all.
Yes. So if you see people doing this, they have to raise money or they have to have money in order to do that. And it's a ceremonial position, obviously. And you represent our country, but obviously the decisions, and there can be moments, I guess, where you're in the mix. But I do think it's... there's a large amount of ceremony with these ambassadorships.
Yes. In fact, they
seem to be a lot of fun. It seems like this is what rich people do for a 4-year vacation and to serve their country. I like it. I could see myself doing it someday.
Oh, I would love to be an ambassador. I have a number of countries I would love to spend time in while wearing a fancy hat and a sash and going to dinners and such. I don't want to pay for it, though.
I think that's how it works. Well, you raise money. You get some benefactors. It's like having a chair at a school. You know, if you want to have like your own chair at Columbia or Harvard, you know, you get somebody to donate a $500,000 or $1 million to pay for it, right? All this stuff has got some underwriting. Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that, but the Greenland point's interesting for two reasons, just to show everyone kind of where next year might be going. One, there is talk about somehow adding Greenland to the U.S. Trump, never sure if we're trolling, never sure if we're being serious, but Ken's caught up in that. And then Trump wants to go and retake the Panama Canal is the latest thing that I've seen.
Well, yeah, there's some talk about the Panama Canal being co-opted by the Chinese or something. That seems like a national security issue. We sold it, so I don't know if we get to get it back. I will say, when they're talking about deporting people and the sort of xenophobic part of the dialogue, which I don't think is actually going to happen. I think that's the rhetoric. I've now become convinced. I don't have inside information, obviously. But I think the rhetoric is 15 million. I think the reality, so we'll talk rhetoric and reality here. Rhetoric, 15 million people dragged out, thrown over the border, you know, chaos. Reality, 50,000, 250,000 violent criminals, people who, you know, steal, jump the turnstile or light somebody on fire in a subway car. Like that's what's going to happen. And there'll be zero tolerance for that, zero tolerance at the border. And then they're going to quietly kind of grandfather this concept of 15 million people being removed, which I think is great. I think opt-in empire building is a great goal for our nation. And just hear me out here.
Okay, I'm here.
I think our goal should be to get to 1 billion Americans and have America be the most populous and the most innovative country in the world. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you get to 1 billion from 350 million? You got to triple. And
just
and there's a certain amount of, you know, population growth through babies, but let's just say people aren't making a ton of babies. So there's two ways to accomplish this. You got to immigrate people or you got to do a little empire building, opt in, of course. I think we should start offering countries to join the United States there would be some decade-long period of integration, getting off of their dollar, whatever, services, voting. Cuba, Puerto Rico, Canada, yes. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's on the other side of the planet. I don't care if it's a Middle Eastern country, an African country. Why wouldn't we have a couple of outposts around the world? The French have some territories, you know, in the BVI, obviously the British Virgin Islands. There's a bunch of these
kind of... French Guiana.
I like the idea of America spreading democracy and building the largest populous country and the largest economy concurrently over the 21st century. Let's try to get to 1 billion Americans. What do you think of my proposal?
Well, I agreed. And I was just trying to find a post that I wrote in which I cheekily said, this was some months ago, that we should, one, Puerto Rico should be a state, clearly. But also I was like, let's just take Canada. We'll take Mexico. Let's just make big, big, big United States, many, many states. And I think it's a great, frankly, idea. Other nations have their own views of sovereignty and so forth. But
well, that's what I'm saying. It's opt-in, right? It's opt-in.
Exactly. Open door policy is great. I do not want us to go out there and grab other countries by the back of the neck and drag them in, because that's going to lead to, I think, a lot of dissension in the ranks. But
nobody
certainly. And
what percentage of people, before you go to your end,
go for it,
would need to vote in favor of joining America for it to seem like you had enough consensus for that, dare I say, transaction to occur?
60. Five.
You think 65? Okay. I was going to say more like 75. I was thinking 75 or 80%.
Oh, wow.
Like the overwhelming majority, a super majority. But you're thinking super majority too with 65. I was thinking the first number that came to my head was 75, 80. But it's maybe between 65 and 80.
It becomes impossible at some point, right? Because if you have the bar set so high, you'll never clear it. And so to me, 60 is too low. 70 feels impossible. That's how I got to 65. But 65, 70%? Yeah. I'm totally here for it.
I have an idea.
Okay.
If it's in order to do the process, you have to have 5 consecutive years of voting 65% or more to join the United States, or 70%. So it has to, you have to vote every year for 5 years for this to happen and start the integration process. Then it's like, listen, the country voted not once, not twice, not 3 times, 5 times over 5 years to join the United States. You know, like there was a little, there's plenty of time to consider it. You didn't have one chance to vote. You had 5, and you had to 5 years in a row have 70% or more. So you had to have real consensus and real discussions about it. Because if in year 3, it dips to 60%, now that resets the clock. Now you got to do 5 years in a row. And we should just go out there and like give our best offer. Maybe there's countries in Europe that would want to be, maybe Greece wants to be part of the United States. Wouldn't that be great for me if Greece was the 51st state, if they wanted to?
Why Greece?
Because I'm Greek.
Oh.
and because we created, man. We created democracy. America perfected it. This would be full circle for me.
I'm so sorry. I did not know your heritage. So I'm like,
golly, Donis,
struggling demographics.
Where have you been?
Famous debt load. I'm like, dude, I'm not picking Greece.
That's
why I
think it's an interesting concept. If you have a debt load, if you have challenges, and another country wants to come in and say, hey, listen, I know you're having challenges. We could help smooth those out. And maybe you'd like to be part of our culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, do you care if you have USD as your currency, or, you know, do you need to have your own currency? Do you want to be part of the EU, or do you want to be part of the United States? Do you want to, you know, be able to come to the United States anytime, back and forth, would not worry about your visa? You know what that would do for Greece? And then if the taxation was similar, retirement was similar, and you just take 20 years to have systems blend together. I mean,
Jason, can you imagine how funny it would be to explain to people who are accustomed to European-style healthcare how healthcare works in the U.S.?
Well, there you have it, right? And so maybe there's things the United States could learn. Like Canada has obviously figured some things out about healthcare. When I talk to Canadians, they complain incessantly about their healthcare. When I talk to Americans, they're like, why isn't our healthcare like Canada's? I'm moving to Canada to get their healthcare system. So they've obviously learned some things. And yeah, that would be amazing for Americans if Canada was the 51st state, if they opted into it, obviously. And Americans could move there and get in Canada as a, you know, state with, you know, multiple, it would obviously be multiple states over time. They would, Americans who went there would get the benefits of their healthcare system, and their healthcare system could be different than ours. And that would be an interesting, concept.
So maybe we need another level here, because we have
territory.
Yeah. United States, 50 states, and then we have the federal government. But what you're describing almost sounds like underneath the federal system, different collections of states with different rules, almost like having blocks.
A territory.
Yeah,
it'd be like the Northeast, the Southwest. You know, this would be the Canada states. So if there were, if they broke into 5, 6, 7 states, whatever it is, it'd be the United States of Canada.
Yeah, well, I mean, hell yeah, I'm a big fan. The thing I was going to throw in there is that I don't think we have to go quite as far abroad to get more folks. I also think that we have lots of room inside the country, and anyone who's flown over the United States once has looked down and gone, wow, there's no one here. And so there's lots of room just inside of the country.
Pick but, a great location for energy and water and climate, given what's happening. What is the perfect place to build a new city and build a city intentionally for 30 million people? Now, it could start as 3 million, but with the intentionality of it hitting 30 million. In other words, a city of the scale of, you know, Beijing or Shanghai.
Yeah.
A mega city, like really going for it. Where would you put the mega city? This would be like such an incredible thing for America to do, to say, we're going to build a mega city. And we're going to start with this plot of American-owned land, because our government owns a lot of land. And we just say, hey, this 1 million acres, this 100,000 acres, 500,000 acres is going to be the city center. And here's how we're going to have this Manhattan Project, where we ask startups and companies to pitch an architecture for the city. And then we're going to pitch neighborhoods. And you as a company, whether it was Google or Boeing, and Google did have a city project, remember, and they have Waymo. Google could come in. Apple could come in and say, I want to build, you know, this hipster neighborhood. This will be the Brooklyn or the Venice or the Berkeley of it. I want to have that territory. I'm going to build Apple apartments, Apple whatever. And I want to have the concession to build a building of, you know, like the Apple headquarters. So Apple's headquarters could become like those rings. They could say, we want to build 10 rings around the city. And we're going to connect the 10 rings with skyways, whatever, a Hyperloop. And people will live in a ring, work in a ring, play in a ring, live in a ring, you know. Steve Jobs considered that one of his great products, the mothership.
Yeah. Well, I remember watching that thing get built. I really like this idea, but I wonder if we have to use federal land, because there's a lot of folks out there who own quite a bit of...
The government could buy from them. Yeah, government could buy from them, and then you...
Sure, I guess you could do it that way. I love the idea. And I think we've seen some nations try this. If you look at Egypt's capital that they're building, kind of de novo. I just think it'd
be cool.
Is that
the UAE? UAE bought some land from them and they're going to build this new city there. And yeah, you have NEOM, which is being built by Saudis.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are some precedents to doing something like this. Hey,
but
moving
on. I love it. I love it. Okay, moving on. Other recent hires by the government. Scott Kapoor, he's going to be the Director of Office of Personnel Management, previously a managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz. Employee number one, been there for about 15 years. I don't know Scott at all. Tell me about
Scott. He's smart. I haven't worked with him, but he's got a great reputation, smart. He's a team player. I don't know what this job does and what the mandate is there.
So I went through their plans and I went through their strategic plans for the OPM from 2022 to 2026. The thing that I struggle with is that they want to make the federal government a leading employer that is technology forward, but also a great place to work. And the struggle, Jason, is that I think a lot of the people who are glad that Scott's taking this job want the federal government to have far fewer people. So not exactly building out the same mission. So here we're going to see someone really come in orthogonal to where things have been heading and probably be a very unpopular person internally. The question is, what are the net benefits for the nation as we go through this? But that's going to be a tough gig.
So the gig is, just looking at it here, human resources for federal employees, their benefits, their strategy to recruit, retain, and maintain the workforce. So basically, it's like being the chief operating officer, human resources department. This sounds like really great to have somebody who's a business person in this. And if the goal is to shrink it and to get rid of the grift, there's a lot of people who are, let's face it, you know, in very high paid jobs and not working. I'm sure there's tons of people who are working more than they're getting paid for. But we all know it's growing too fast. We're in debt. We're spending too much money. Get in there. If you cut too deep, you can always add people back, is the philosophy that I think we'll see. And I know it sounds cutthroat, but that is how you save money.
Let's screen share one more time here.
Okay.
Jason, this is the federal employment.
Right.
Over
what period of time?
This is 1940 through today.
Is that percentage?
Nope.
Or is there
thousands of persons? So it's the federal government is not. Now, this doesn't include, the military, but it's not that many people.
Which one is that? Because, it has grown.
Now, there's at state, it gets higher.
Yeah, because you have state, you have military. There's a bunch of different data points here that we need to look at. The federal, 3 million, state, 5.5, local, 14.5, according to the Daily Caller. So I'm not sure if that's correct or not. But so anyway, we can debate how many people there should be in the government. I think maybe you and I agree there should be less.
Oh, fewer. I just think that people think that the federal government has 45 million employees who are all sitting around playing Tetris in their flip-flops. And it's several million people. So if we're going to cut spend, I really do think that there's a goal and there's a method to reach that goal. And we talk about cutting spending and cutting staff as a way to get there. I just don't think that this number is going to add up to anything approaching impacting the actual spend and debt issue.
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
So if we're going to do this, we got to cut somewhere else and it's going to hurt.
It doesn't have to hurt because my guess is one third of the employees aren't contributing a bunch and the top third, are doing 80% of the work. And then there's the middle third. So if you cut a third, I've seen this in every organization I've ever worked with, you cut the bottom 10, 20, 35%, you will see universally the company works more efficiently. And that's just the nature of any organization.
That's totally
fine.
Et cetera. I agree with that.
That's how I would do it.
What I meant was we're going to have to make painful cuts on spending, like entitlement programs, that sort of thing. So the staffing, we can definitely cut 30%. I'm sure. I think you and I talked about this a while back. If it's 35% or if it's 50%, you can cut whatever. But that's going to be a very small percentage change in our overall spend.
The military is the big number.
Interest on the debt and so forth.
Yeah. There's a lot of places to cut. But, I think a lot of it is also a philosophy. And the philosophy is going to be efficiency and competition. And no more cronyism and grifting. I think that's what's going to happen is opening up, that philosophy. And I'm here for it. And, listen, if you don't believe they're going to do it, if you believe there's crony capitalism at work, it's going to be pretty obvious to see it. It's going to be right there on display. So you will see it. I can tell you based on what I know, even the most cynical Democrats, the most cynical who hate Trump are going to have to nod and say, it's my prediction. We'll be sitting here a year from now. I think they did a good job on those issues. I give it to them for that. Whether it's, making the military more competitive, cutting spending, reducing spending. And just as a philosophy, you're starting to see, and I'll just, as we look at these appointments, we'll go through them in a moment, here's where I've come to. People know I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, have been super critical. All the receipts are out there. You can see me saying all the things I believe about his past performance. My belief is he's the president now, and I'm seeing him surround himself with, quite literally, all of my friends and colleagues. My dream has always been that the government be as efficient as Silicon Valley, as entrepreneurs, and it should be more entrepreneurial and more efficient. Guess what? I just got my dream. This has always been my dream, is to see more people. And for me, that version of it was, I wanted Bloomberg to win. He got knocked out in the first debate. Knockout punch. Brutal. It is what it is. But I want to see Jamie Dimon in there. I want to see more business people in there, less career politicians, and really make the thing more efficient. So here's what my pitch is to everybody who doesn't like Trump. You have a year of action that you'll watch. You can be as critical as you want to be. Bang on every assumption, everything they're doing, and just judge them in a year. Because you know what? You have no choice but to do that. You can fight them as much as you want. You can tweet, you can scream, but they won. And they won with a bit of a mandate. And so here we go. Let's see. And some Democrats, including Bernie Sanders, are on board with some of these issues. So I think when they start voting on them, there's going to be a lot of Democrats who cross the aisle and say, and there'll also be some Republicans who break rank, but they'll say, you know what? I agree. We should spend a little less here. So it's going to be entertaining. It's going to be a shakeup.
absolutely. I'll take quite a lot of that. And I like the fact that we will be able to vet results based on the numbers. For example, we know how much money we were spending. We will know how much money that we do spend. We will see if yearly deficits decline. We will see if the federal employment numbers decline. We will be able to actually kind of go out and see what they can do. So I don't think anyone was saying that everything we were doing was going well. So here's a new way forward. Okay. What I struggle with is the demand for, whenever the Republicans win, everyone goes, we all have to get together now and all have to hold hands and work together. And when the Democrats win, the Republicans go, they want to bring Satan back and beat up your children. And I struggle a little bit to be as big of a person as you're asking me to be when the other side that I'm being forced to hold hands with is going to turn around and slap me the first chance they get when the tables are turned. Okay, though, I was raised Christian, turn the other cheek, all right. But I gotta say, people have tried this before. We have tried blue ribbon commissions, which is what DOGE is, to cut spending. We have tried things. Let's see what we get. Now, other people that are coming in, Jason, include Sriram Krishnan, former GP over at Andreessen. He's going to advise on AI policy. I've met him once, but it was back when I was a mess.
He was embedded by Andreessen Horowitz at Twitter when the takeover happened. So I spent a little bit of time with him there for the first couple of weeks. He is a hardcore, great human being, really solid individual, great communicator, hard worker. He's going to do great.
He's going to work with David Sacks. So he's going to be inside of the AI and crypto policy spot. And he was, if I recall, very active on the crypto side of investing for Andreessen.
Yes.
So he'll be bringing, I think, a little more crypto to David Sacks's AI.
Yeah, his group. Yeah, I guess there's a group being formed and crypto needs to be regulated. And if we look at what happened the last 4 years, it was kind of Gary Gensler gave no path. He didn't give the third path. It was either you can't do it or you can do it my way or the way we've always done it.
So, exactly.
Don't do it or do it the way it's always been done. There is, in fairness to everybody in crypto, they should have a rule set that has evolved, and the SEC, Congress, whatever commissions they come up with, whoever winds up, you know, working on this, they need to light a fire and make us, America, the most open to cryptocurrency geography in the world. It should not be the Zerg, or it should not be some communist country or North Korea or, you know, Switzerland. It should be America. This is where we have the largest number of entrepreneurs pushing them to be in Puerto Rico, offshore, hiding their money. I've told the stories before. I've been on the boards of companies that are, you know, adjacent to crypto or in crypto. And they're like, we're going to put this in, literally, speaking of Panama, in Panama.
Yes.
In a nonprofit. It's going to cost $1 million to set it up. And I'm like, what? What corporation costs $1 million to set up? I can go on like any number of sites and register a new company for $500 or free or $1,000. It makes no sense. So let's not drive it offshore. Let's regulate it. Let's tax it. And I believe we should build a Bitcoin reserve. You know how we should do it? If you want to trade in Bitcoin in the United States, there is a 1% Bitcoin tax. You want to buy it, you want to sell it, both sides pay 1% on every transaction. You know where it goes?
Right into the Bitcoin government. Trust?
That's it.
That's, our government's that is not going to. Interesting.
I mean, if I told you Bitcoin was totally legal, was totally sanctioned in the United States, and you could go crazy with it, have fun with it, and we came up with maybe a capital gains, you know, treatment for it that was different or unique in some way. But we said, hey, we're going to go down and we're going to help XRP and Doge and whatever else is out there, Solana. We're going to help them have a very clear regulatory environment. But every time you trade in and out of crypto, both sides pay 1% and it goes to the government wallet.
I want to ask a question about this, because I have been lightly sympathetic to the idea that crypto does not match one-to-one to existing securities law, and we might need a couple of tweaks to make it work a little bit better for crypto. It sounds, though, when you say third way and, you know, a different approach, that you're anticipating something a little bit more broad, Jason. So not
to
put you on the spot, but I'm
kind
of curious, like, why does crypto need a separate and more lenient set of rules compared to traditional securities like you and I know and love?
Great question. You cannot take your Netflix shares and use them to fund a rendering cluster of computers and then burn those, you know, as a utility token, et cetera. So those shares just exist as a piece of paper in a ledger somewhere that you own a share of a company. They don't have any utility in the real world. An NFT is a collectible. It's obviously the NFTs. People are buying them when they buy a Beeple NFT. It's a one of one. It's a piece of art. He is a known artist. That doesn't fit in there either. So, and then when you have a DAO and everybody's voting on what to do with their crypto and which NFTs to buy, and then what rights the NFTs have, can they come to this party, that party? That's more like a membership club, but it trades like a currency. These are called innovations. Those innovations should be allowed, but we should allow them while making sure that people don't steal the money and grift. And if it's permissionless and there's a network of computers that nobody owns, the network, but each individual's own nodes, well, then that has to be accounted for as well, because who's responsible when somebody loses their money who's a retiree in Florida? Well, here's very simple regulation. Each of these projects has to have an overseeing committee. That overseeing committee gets paid compensation in order to make sure there's insurance for the project, that there is KYC, that it's not, that people are looking to make sure it's not being used for money laundering or terrorists or human trafficking or whatever terrible thing that could be done with these cryptocurrencies. That's people have reported is being, that Tether is being used for. There's many reports. No. It is the currency of choice for, you know, the criminal underground, which, by the way, $100 bills were also part of that. Gold bullion and diamonds are part of that. It just happens to be Tether is a quicker way than handing somebody an ounce of gold for whatever you're trafficking. So I think those are all examples of things that, you know, the current system doesn't take into account. And it's very simple. Accreditation. Start with a sophistication test. I have been shouting this on every All-In episode, every This Week in Startup episodes for, well, 14 years, ever since I got exposed to this, because I know that people want to, in my family, in my friend circles, you know, or employees of mine, want to participate in something like the syndicate.com where we share deals. Mm-hmm. 90% of the deals will probably go to zero in any of those platforms. And so I expect ours will be similar. And I wrote a book about this. And there's a book called The Power Law. People love to get educated about this stuff, but I can't offer for, I don't know, a million Americans to put in $100 each into a startup, like, let's say, Cafe X, which we did some syndicates for the top 5%. But maybe the public wants to buy shares of Uber or Robinhood when I had access to them. And I could have said, you know what? I'm going to do something where I offer to drivers the ability for them to put in $100 to $1,000. They're not allowed to. But they know Uber and DoorDash and Lyft and Sidecar before it better than anybody because they're doing it all day long. But they're not allowed to be to participate. So just start with the accreditation laws is my message to Washington. And then let people participate in risky things as a percentage of their income or net worth. Those two things would solve the whole problem. You want to buy XRP? And, you know, half the people think it's a scam. Half the people think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Great. You can spend up to 10% of your net worth on anyone on cryptocurrencies in this experimental category.
I find it very interesting that your example about Netflix maps so neatly to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Own a bit of Netflix, sits in a ledger somewhere that you own it, and you can't use it in a DAO. It's not a utility token. It's not going to get burned. That's holding ETH or holding Bitcoin, which would make them, by my logic, securities. And this is when I really begin to struggle. I do think that there's something to your point about how we have DAOs and other things that don't quite map to securities. And if you buy a token that is designed to be a lever on a system instead of a corporation or as a group, sure. But like,
what if a musician?
Yeah.
What's your favorite heavy metal band?
Fit for an Autopsy
says we are putting out a new double record.
Hell yes.
And it's going to cost us. Are they a major signed label band or are they?
They're on Nuclear Blast Records, Jason.
So maybe they spend $250,000 to make an album.
Sure.
I'm putting a number out there.
Somewhere between that and 500, yes.
Okay, so let's say 500,000 is what it costs to make a really high quality record. They say, hey, you know, our label dropped us, but we're going to offer our fans $500,000 and you each get to own for, you know, every $5,000 is 1% of that record for all eternity. And so you get your name on the back cover.
Yeah, okay.
They can't do that right now. They can't do that. They're not allowed to. They can do it for 5% of the country at an expensive cost. But what if you said, you know what? For me, it's about supporting the band. I want to own 20 basis points, $1,000. For me, being able to go to the concert to get a signed album. Mm-hmm. So every $1,000 gets a signed album. So they have to sign 500 albums. Would you spend $1,000 to get a signed album, go to the concert, and have your name in the record label notes as one of the producers?
Oh, yeah. I would do that for no recognition. If the band was like, we're broke, send us money, I would send them money.
So, okay. They do that for their album, and mm-hmm. they get to own their masters for all time, and the community gets to own half of their masters alongside them. Love so it. Half of the equity goes to them, half goes to the community. You can't do that right now. Why can't you do that? Because we have antiquated security laws that want to protect you, Alex, and the other fans from spending your money. You're not allowed to do it because in the eyes of the SEC, you're not sophisticated enough, which is another way of saying you're dumb.
Well, just as a reminder to everyone, what Jason's talking about in the accreditation test, according to SEC.gov, currently the financial criteria is net worth over $1 million, excluding your house, or if you and your spouse make $300K or more per year in each of the last 2 years.
So you're accredited probably. But anyway, putting it all aside. Yes. Putting it all aside, you 10 years ago weren't accredited.
Oh, God, no. I was anti-accredited.
And that's when, so back then, you were writing for TechCrunch. You were brilliant. I met you in your first couple of years in the business. You were too stupid in the minds of the government, unsophisticated, mm-hmm. to do that. No, you were sophisticated enough to go take your $1,000 and play poker and lose it to your friends or give it to, you know, whoever. You go to Vegas and put it on a roulette wheel.
Sure.
So well, that's what I'm talking about. And,
so
and that's the kind
agreed.
Of stuff that you could then sell it. Let's say that album becomes one of the best-selling albums of all time. Mm. And your equity in it's worth 3X. And your kid's going to college and your $5,000 turned into $15,000 and you want it for college. You could sell it to somebody else in the Dow instantly without any going public or anything, just in a wallet. So the way I would say it is projects under $100 million in total market cap should be able to do whatever the hell they please as long as they're registered in some way with this is the people who have started the project and we have some basic insurance that costs $1,000 or something.
So I love all of that, Jason. Like you're speaking my language. I would love to have more ways to work with fans of other artists that I love, especially bands that are struggling in the Spotify era. But here's the thing. All we need to do that is to just update the securities laws to be a little bit less stupid. None of that requires a special set of rules for crypto that's distinct. So to me, I don't think we need a third way. I think we need a more intelligent main path.
Sure.
And I just think that it's not a sin that many assets in the crypto world are securities. And so what we should do is we should just make the securities aperture a little bit wider, which I think is what you're arguing. I think we're getting to the same place here.
Yeah, I'm saying a third way. Because I think there's so much innovation here that you really need to start from a blank sheet of paper and really understand, you know, is this a situation where you do need to know your customer or not? Right? Is this a situation where it has to be registered? If it's like NFTs, you know, and they're trading under a certain dollar amount and they're trading cards, like, I don't know that you need to be so worried about KYC, et cetera. That's why I think you could like let people start small projects as the projects get bigger. If there's a central authority, they have to register, et cetera. But you're correct that a lot of what I'm saying could also be viewed as evolving the securities law. And when I say a test, I mean a test similar to a driver's license, an easily accessible test, not something you pay where you go to school for a year or two. I'm talking about you spend 6 hours in a course on your own time. That's a free course online. And then you take a 50 or 150 question test and you're licensed. In other words, you can't go back to the people who sold you a JPEG and say, oh, this JPEG isn't worth the $50,000 I spent on it or the $5,000 or the $500 because you took a test that said there's no inherent value to this because it's a piece of art. And the only way for this to have value is for somebody else to believe it has value, and there may not be a buyer for your piece of art ever again because you picked the wrong piece.
Yes, well, that's why I buy all art on the predication of I love it, comma, if it goes up in value, huzzah. We have a couple more names, though. Emil Michael, former Uber executive, named Undersecretary for Research and Engineering.
Fantastic.
Congrats to Emil. I don't know him at all. I know you do. And so tell me why he's the right guy.
I mean, he was Travis's right-hand man. He will get any deal done. He is just, if you wanted to have a deal maker by your side, He'd be top three in the industry to grab if you wanted an operator, you know, deal maker, aggressive. You know, this is like getting a version of Travis on your team for the government. And so whether you like business people or not, sharp elbow people or not, aggressive people or not, in our government, we've had the opposite. I am here to have aggressive, hardcore, driven people who want to perform at a high level in the government. I predict all these nervous Nellies, all these people who are negative about this right now, you know, who are like, oh my God, this is oligarchs, we're turning into oligarchy. I think these people actually are doing it in a patriotic way. And I think we're going back to a founding fathers type situation where the most successful people in the private sector go do a tour of duty, give up making money for 4 years, 8 years, whatever it is, and then they come back into the private sector. Or in some cases, they're able to do both in some of these positions, but some you can't. And we don't know in each of these positions which ones are, you have to divest everything and you can't.
We're going to find out. I can't wait to read the financial disclosures. I wonder who's poorer than we think.
Well, I mean, and then the other thing is, you know, they're going to, in some cases, have to divest. And if you're worried that people are going to be, people are going to be grifting or talking their own book or working their own book, this is something that exists already. All these generals, all these people working in defense do like whatever number of years at Raytheon. Then they go work in government. They go back to Raytheon. It's a revolving door. It's well known. It's a problem. Here you have high profile people who've already made their money. We're playing for legacy. I would judge them based on that. And just, you'll know if there's any type of corruption or grift, it is going to come out so fast because AOC, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and that group are so tuned in to making sure it doesn't happen. There are checks and balances in our system. That's my belief. I could be wrong. This could be one of those clips that gets played and people go, look, you were wrong, but I am an optimist. I think that this is the default case. I think everybody's going to be quite pleased with the performance of these individuals.
Okay. Well, that brings us to one last name, just adding one more to the mix because Jason's giving them all lots of points. So one more for the scoreboard. Michael Kratsios. Someone that actually, this is new to me, is going to help with Saxon on emerging technologies. Currently an MD at Scale AI, a company that we all know. But this was one of the tech people that I didn't
already
have follow on.
Yeah, I don't have a relationship with them. Can't speak to it. But again, I think what we're going to see is a really young, high energy, tech first, entrepreneurship first, less regulation, lower taxes, less spending, more efficient and competitive America. That's my guess. And I think people are going to learn to appreciate what this group can do.
Yes.
And back to people with Trump derangement syndrome or who don't like Trump or who have, you know, concerns about his leadership and his track record. In this Trump 2.0 era, my major concern was that people who I consider incompetent, racist, xenophobic, deranged, dumb, the whack pack. Remember some of the whack pack he had around him the last time around, like really bad actors, people with nefarious intent, people who were really dark individuals in my estimation. Now you've got people who are rabid capitalists. This is the ultimate upgrade. This is the ultimate upgrade. Steve Bannon versus Emil Michael or David Sachs, like massive upgrade. So thank your lucky stars is the way I'm looking at this. If this was Trump 1.0 and it was a bunch of Steve Bannons, then I'd be super concerned. This is a much better turnout. So that's another way for people who have concerns to maybe think relative to who Trump could hang out with. Maybe this is better.
No, I definitely, I'll take someone who's run a business over Steve Bannon because I would take the gum stuck to the bottom of my shoe before Steve Bannon. So low bar there. But I do appreciate the optimistic take here.
I'm trying to be optimistic.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, these, in some cases, are many of my close friends, so I am as biased as that comes. I am the
most biased. I understand that. But this is one of the times in which I think bias is useful.
Yeah.
Because you're speaking from not just people that you've met a handful of times, like a great many people that journalists meet, you know, 3, 4, 5 times total.
Yeah.
These are people that you know very deeply. And so that gives you, I think, a better view into what they'll do when people aren't looking, which I think is basically what character
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely. I can tell you, David Sachs made enough money. Elon's made enough money. Emil Michael's made enough money. I know that they don't need, they're not doing this for money. I've had conversations with many of these people about why they're doing it. I won't say which ones. They're doing it because they actually think America needs them. So whether you think that's deranged, delusional, delusions of grandeur, put it all aside. They feel called to serve. They mm-hmm. feel called to put, you know, whatever number of years of entrepreneurship and increasing their net worth during one of the great eras in technology, the AI era. They think it's more important to save America in their minds. They literally yes. think they're saving America. Now, people will laugh at it. People will criticize it. But I can tell you that's truly what they think. They want to, they think that national debt's an existential issue and they want to help and they want to make the government more efficient. I say give them 12 months and write a scorecard.
Yeah. Well, I, the only thing I'll say is I do hope that people remember that, and I just pulled up the latest numbers, that Trump won 49.9% of the vote.
Yes.
Now, that is 1.5% more than Kamala did. Shout out. Yeah. But I'll just
3 million? What was it? 3 million Americans more?
Let's see. It's 2.3 million more.
Okay. So
it's they won. Shout out.
Yes.
But I do hope that there's also a recognition that not everyone has the exact same vision. And so I hope other people also have a chance to have a voice.
Literally, the reason I'm saying this is because I know that there are a bunch of people who are very concerned. And I have told them, and I said it on an episode of All In. I think it's important for Republicans who have a very high troll level, a very high vengeance level, you know, explicitly stated, for them to say, you know what, let's do this for all Americans. And I told them on the other side, again, Captain Nuance here, I am a moderate. Just like I'm telling the people on the left, hey, give them a chance, judge them based on the results. I told them publicly on the All In Pod, on my Twitter, and I've told them privately, do not troll people and make sure the benefits of DOGE, make sure the benefits of efficiency are felt by the bottom half first. And my pitch to them was all the gains that we see, if we can get, you know, back in the black as opposed to going into debt, let's say we're back in the black by whatever amount and we can reduce taxes. They should just come out and say, you know what? All tax reductions for the next 4 years are going to the bottom 75% of the country. The top 25% are not going to get any tax breaks. That would be the high ground.
I would love to see a tax package that was actually progressive in that way. History is not kind to that kind of expectation, but there's always a new chapter to be written. So again, leaning on your optimism here, I'll take it.
Okay.
Because here's the thing, Jason, we're in the car. We're going over the cliff. Geronimo. So like, it isn't like we're like opting in or out here. You and I are side by side here and someone else is driving. Yeah. And
I mean, my perception of you now working with you, a couple times a week here is you're a moderate techno-optimist who is liberal socially. Am I correct?
Capitalism, technology, and gay rights.
Okay, awesome. And so you put that package together. I think we're in a good place right now. I think you're going to be pleased with how this goes.
Well, I mean, look, I love a good surprise. But before we go, I have a couple of really funny comments from the audience that I do want to bring up.
Yes.
So a while back, Toronto filmmaker Irvon X said, right now, 13% of Canadians are in favor of joining the U.S., according to a recent poll. So we have some work to do to get Canada on our side.
13%,
it's currently upside down, but I like that. And LMNOP, that's a great name.
LMNOP.
says, Greenland would be great for natural cooling of data centers. To which I say to you, LMNOP, yes, but have you heard about climate change? So that will have a multi-hundred year ceiling to it.
Interesting you bring that comment up. There have been data centers that were put in cold locations with good natural energy sources. Mm-hmm. And somebody told me the way they designed them is to put fans in them and to have the wind and where they place them be where cold air will blow into it. So during certain months, they actually literally can open the doors as it is on either side of the data center and have the freezing air blow through the H100s and cool them down.
I
don't know if that's reality, but that was explained to me by a data center expert that existed as a concept.
Did you see that Microsoft thing from like, I want to say 5 years ago when they wanted to put a data center in like a shipping container underwater?
Yes.
And that was going to prevent the natural. I thought that was so cool. And that was before the AI boom. So I want to know, actually, okay, here's a question. If you are building something or to our friends in the audience, that involves really, really insane data center cooling. Alex W@launch.co, shoot me an email. I want to talk to you because this is an issue that I just love. Jason, we have one more show before the end of the year, and it's the Twisty, so it's going to be a little bit more retrospective.
Great.
So let's
end here.
And on a positive note of just saying that let's hope everything goes better than we expect and may everybody benefit to the nth degree, and may this be the new onset of an American century, and my concerns be wrong.
Yeah, golden age. Let's do a golden age. Stay positive, folks, because you have no choice.
We're in the car.
You're in the car with Thumb and Louise heading towards the cliff, folks. We'll see you all on Monday with the Twisty Awards. Sign up for the channels. And my pitch to you is in 2025, I want you to start a company. Be independent, start a company, you know, like Alex did. He works here with me, but he also has cautiously optimistic.
Cautious optimism.
We have to put that in your lower third. Can we get lower thirds here now that we're using Restream? Cautious optimism, then I won't mess it up. Cautiousoptimism.substack.com, I believe, is the newsletter. Give him the $100. Yeah, you know, help him out here. Let's build a foundation. He's being entrepreneurial. He's here half the time, and he's doing his newsletter half the time. And founder.university, which I'm going to be bringing, and I'll be announcing next year, that Founder University is going to be coming to another region in the world.
You teased AI with Sunny. If you want to go get a little more, there you go. Go back in the archive.
Founder.university coming to another region in the new year. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.